Thank you, Demis. That was wonderful and not only a fascinating problem, but what a great adventure for yourself to be part of that and find these solutions that you already were kind of dreaming of as a child, yeah, in some sense. I had this first question is, now, if you think of these, what these programs can do, let's start with the games. Mm-hmm. Do you have a feeling why they are doing this? Is there some way in which AlphaGo can tell you, so to say, mm-hmm, what the magic is? Could it be a good Go teacher?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so at the moment, in fact, the top Go players and chess players, in fact, I'm writing a book with a chess grandmaster about AlphaZero's, the style it plays. Because it plays such novel ideas and in novel ways, you can actually learn those motifs yourself and incorporate them into your own play. But currently, that's by viewing and analyzing the games it produces. What we would really like is to be able to dig into the brain itself, if yes, you like, and actually look at how it's making its decisions.
Because it's a bit like an idiot savant, right?
Yes.
It just knows, but it can't really right, know why.
It can't express it.
Yes.
But we're going to start analyzing. We're doing this at the moment. We're building visualization tools, and we're building analytic tools to start investigating the neural network while it's making these decisions. So you can think of it as a bit analogous to, in neuroscience, building an fMRI machine,
yes,
for the artificial neural network. In fact, we call it virtual brain analytics. So I actually have a team of neuroscientists that are inspired by the work that's done in neuroscience to port all of that knowledge and those tools and those visualization tools to AI.
So does AlphaZero has a personality? Does this to say, no, you develop this particular program,
yep,
it become incredibly successful,
yep,
in beating, but it does it with a certain style.
Yes, it has a very...
If another company would build another program, could it have a different style and a different
potentially
personality?
So it has a very distinctive style.
How
so
would you describe it?
Well, it depends on the game, but it's very... So in Go, it's called a cosmic style, which means it plays all over the board. So usually in Go, because it's quite a complicated game, you concentrate on one part of the board, then you concentrate on another part, and then another,
yes,
part. And the top players would love to play in this style where it's called all-board style. So you take into account all of the ways the different corners are interacting. But of course, that's a very complicated thing to do.
Yes.
And that's the way Go plays. And in chess, it plays in this a very adventurous, aggressive style and risky style, actually. And sacrificing all these pieces and being very calm about it. So it doesn't,
doesn't
worry about trying to get back the pieces. And that's actually quite an interesting reason why it can do that, because, and this is worth illustrating the difference between expert systems and learning systems. So with chess programs, one of the first rules you put into a chess program is the value of the pieces,
yes,
right? So those of you who play chess, you know, the rook is 5 points, the knight is 3 points, and so on, right? Queen is 9 points. And so you know not to swap, you're taught as a beginner not to swap the rook for the knight, because you lose 2 points, right? You know, the rook is 5 points. So if you want to make that sacrifice, the chess computer has to overcome its inbuilt rule. Right? It has to calculate out.
Biases.
Yes, it has to calculate out. Oh, eventually in 10 moves time, I'll win back something bigger than the rook, and so it'll be worth me sacrificing this. But in many positions, you can't calculate all of that out. Even a chess computer can't do that. So it wouldn't make the sacrifice. But for AlphaZero, it hasn't got this fixed notion of values. We didn't put that in there.
Right.
It's learned to value pieces contextually in the current situation. So AlphaZero has no problem going, oh, in this position, your knight is super powerful and blocking my plan, and I've got a rook that isn't doing very much, so I'm going to swap it off.
Yes.
Right? It doesn't need to overcome this inbuilt bias of -2 points. Right?
You know, Richard Feynman, the physicist, famously described that science is like watching a chess game without anybody telling you what the rules are.
Yes.
And then you understand everything, and then, you know, one of the pawns makes it to the other side,
yes,
and gets promoted. So what's that?
Yeah. No, exactly.
You said you're this kind of risky behavior,
yeah,
of these programs, and I think we saw this also nicely illustrated with the Atari,
yep,
version. If you think about this kind of more intuitive way of learning, and suppose that these kind of systems are replacing expert systems.
Yes.
You might worry about what kind of risk does the system take, and what is, in some sense, the probability of failure.
Yeah. So I think it's very, you know, this is, we think about this problem a lot, and the field does a lot, and we're still quite nascent because these systems are quite new, and they've only just started to work in the last 5 years.
Have you seen examples of that?
Well, yes, of course.
Do something really crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that. I mean, even AlphaGo does that sometimes under certain conditions. So what I would advocate is if you're in a safety critical environment like healthcare or something like that, then these systems should not be making the decision. Uh-huh. They should be just advising. Right, so I think of them as a powerful tool, but the human expert makes the final decision. So the way you can think about it is like having the world's greatest research assistant, right, at your disposal. But you, as the expert, the doctor or the surgeon or the scientist, make the judge makes the final determination. But this is just extra input. So that's the first stage.
Yes.
So the next stage is then if we can build these visualization tools and analysis tools that actually start giving insights to how the black box system is coming to its decisions, then you can use probably more mathematical techniques to prove out certain things about the system. So my colleagues at MIT are working on this, and there's a lot of very smart mathematicians actually working on that. And then the final thing, of course, is that at the very least, eventually when these systems are able to use language, they should be able to express what they're thinking, at least as well as humans can to each other.
If you now look at the world around, so would you say there's any way to predict where, you know, even if you have the amount of data and you have the computing power, whether this problem will be solved or not? I know, for instance, language translation was for a long time also seen as impenetrable.
Yep.
But then certainly with enough power and enough data, it was solvable. I mean, do you have in some sense a sense what the heights of the mountains are that you try to climb?
Yeah, we do. We have a sense of how many there are and you know how high they are. But that's an ongoing evaluation. So
what would you describe as the foothills, the things?
So I mean, I think we've I would say we've climbed two mountains so far, probably maybe out of say 20, right? Uh-huh. So the first one was the Atari program, the deep reinforcement learning. That was the first ever end-to-end learning system that went from, you know, the raw data to solving the problem. And then AlphaGo, I think, has taken that the next step further, in combining it with search and planning now. So there are many hard problems. I listed that on one slide there, memory, imagination, all these difficult things that we know humans are very capable of, but so far AI systems are not.
Do you dare to make any predictions, say, in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, so I think the next things, I mean, we're working on are giving systems the ability to remember things. So for now, these neural networks, you know, you can think of them, they're kind of like, idiot savants, as you call them, right? Or amnesics, because right now, you know, their input comes into the neural networks, and then an output comes out. Then the next input comes in, and it wipes out all of the state that the neural network had, and now that kind of washes through, and then there's a new output. But what if you needed to remember what happened to you?
But it does change the architecture, right? I mean, the links are so
right over
has
time.
Memory,
so there's
right?
some hard yes, but that takes a lot of experience. It's like very hard coded memory.
Right.
What you want is some fast memory, something like the hippocampus, which is what I studied for my neuroscience PhD, which is the area of the brain that is responsible for episodic memory. So remembering, you know, like this tomorrow, if we think back to this this talk today, that is not going to be encoded in your hardwired in your synapses. That's the hippocampus that's going to record that. So AI systems don't currently have, well, they're beginning to have the beginnings of that. And then the big thing we want to tackle is actually the learning of abstract knowledge. So what I would call concepts. So at the moment, these systems I showed you are intuitive in that they're dealing with raw actions and raw data. But what we would like them to do is that a breakout system I showed you, it would be great if it what it actually did was reverse engineer Newton's laws of motion and then output that to you. Right? And say, look, this is, I understand what's happening with the bat and ball here. It's Newton's laws of motion. And furthermore, I can apply that to a new situation that I've never seen before with another bat and a ball. And that's that would be called transfer learning.
Because in some sense, as you're saying, this is much more intuitive learning.
Yes.
So for instance, it's like throwing a ball, like we humans know how to throw a ball. Some are very good at it.
Yeah.
In some sense, we managed Newton's law, but we were throwing balls long before Newton, right?
Yes,
so,
exactly.
So it took a long of time to abstract these phenomena into general laws.
Yes. So you can think of the systems. They're learning a bit like a young child. You know, as you say, they have an intuitive notion of physics without knowing anything about the equations and transferability of that. What we'd like to do is get to the next stage.
They seem to be more like teenagers since they're wild in their explorations.
Yep.
Now, you mentioned the impact of neuroscience and all of that. And It's quite remarkable, but perhaps you can say a word about that, that you, after quite a successful career in computer science and designing games, why you decided to go back into academics and learn neuroscience?
Well, so my plan from around the age of 12 or 13 was always to work in AI, and that came through my chess, actually, because I was thinking about thinking. So I was trying to improve how I played chess, and then I was quite introspective as a child, so I was trying to think about my own thought process and how to improve that, and then that led me to thinking more generally about how does the brain come up with these ideas and these moves and plans, right? You know, it's kind of fascinating. And then, you know, I got my first computer when I was about 8 and started programming, and around 12, 13, I wrote my first AI program, which was a games program to play the game called Reversi in America, in the US, or Othello in the UK, which is it's a much simpler form of Go. And that got me hooked on it.
That
and
was an expert program that you were writing. Yes.
And then and I thought, wow, you know, if you can do that on this relatively small computer, what could you do if we really push that? And the thing is, I always found AI and computers are fascinating devices, because to me, all machines are amazing, right, in some sense. Like cars allow us to move faster than we can run, planes we can fly, but the computers are extensions of our minds. That's how I see it. It's a machine for the mind. And I still get a kick today out of setting a program off before you go to sleep, and then waking up the next day and it's solved some problem for you. And you've sort of outsourced your mental effort to this machine, or maybe even a million machines today. And to me, that's like an amazing efficiency gain for your mind, and something kind of incredible that that even exists in the world, I think. And so so I've always been drawn to that. And then so computers are amazing devices in themselves, and then to me, AI is the obvious sort of end goal for that, where the machines themselves can intelligently do things on their own.
In terms of this kind of
trajectory. So neuroscience, yes.
Yeah. So you're only like midway, right?
Right. Yes.
Also in terms of your dream that
you
had.
Yes. Only midway. So the I started off with computer science.
Yes.
As my undergrad, and then all the computer games I used to make professionally had AI as their core component. And I wasn't very impressed with academic computer science at the time. This was in the early 90s, because it was all expert systems. And I already felt that there was something not correct about this expert system approach. There was something really vital missing, which, you know, is learning and generality, which I went through. And so I was not drawn at all to AI as an academic subject, because I felt that it was going down the wrong way.
Yeah.
And you can see that they were trying to solve natural language by using logic, first order logic. And it's clear that we don't talk when we talk non-grammatically all the time, yet we can understand each other, right?
So it's very difficult to learn logic.
Right, and it's very difficult to learn logic, but we all learn language. So there's something not quite right about that view. And I actually got thrown out of one of my AI lectures once, because I said it too loudly to one of my students. I was saying they're brainwashing us, because they were teaching us this classical AI, and it's the only lecture I've ever been thrown out of. And because the lecturer stopped, I think I said it too loudly, and the lecturer stopped the lecture and said, "Do you think you know everything in this lecture?" And he said, "If you do, don't come back." So I didn't for the AI lectures, but it's a
thanks to him.
Well, yes, but neuroscience was always fascinating me, because I felt that we could what was missing was actually what the brain does effortlessly.
Yes.
Right, this learning, this generality, memory.
Can I come back to that point?
Yeah.
The brain, you say it's an inspiration.
Yes.
For the architecture, but honestly, it's not really one-to-one, right? Our brain is very different.
No. So what I advocated, so I went back to academia to ostensibly learn about the brain, how the brain does certain functions that I wanted to imbue the machines with, right? And we, at that point, didn't have any ideas for. So I was trying to be inspired by the brain, but on a systems level. So I call it systems neuroscience. And what I mean by that is the algorithms the brain implements and the representations it uses, not the actual implementation details of the wetware, right? So a lot of people are trying to work on, there's the EU, you know, Blue Brain Project, billion euro Europe brain project, which I think is not the right way to approach building AI, because you don't want to copy slavishly all the neurons in the brain exactly how they work, because there's lots of specific nuances about that that I believe are just to do with the way biology has to work.
Yeah.
And there's no reason to think...
That's also history dependent to
right.
4 billion years.
Well, and there's certain reasons. You know, we have to... there's certain constraints around the biology
right.
that the silicon isn't going to have. It will have different constraints. So there's no reason, in my opinion, why the implementation is going to be similar for an in-carbo system to an in-silico system. But the principles may well be the same. So it's the principles of intelligence that I'm
right.
interested in, and that's what I look to when I look at neuroscience.
So touched on the ethical matters, and you already said you know you're quite active in building
yes.
coalitions around
yes.
this. If you kind of approach it from kind of a negative perspective, if you would be advocating the devil's advocate here,
sure.
what are the things you're most worried about?
Well, I think there's three sets of things that you can categories of things to worry about. There's, I call it the technical problems, the ethical problems, and the strategic issues. And so the technical ones are making sure these types of learning systems are controllable, and they do, you can specify, they do what you want them to do. So one of the big philosophical debates about these learning systems is how can you make sure, how do you specify the goal?
Right,
I kind of skipped over that in my presentation. But how do you make sure, you know, that the system only does the goal that you want and nothing collateral? Right, and many science fiction books have been written about this, right? So that's called the control problem.
The problem with teenagers.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So there's a control problem. and how do we imbue it with the values that we want as a society?
Yeah.
What would those values even be?
Yeah.
Right. So that's a whole
because
kind
you,
of
on the one hand you wanted to think outside the box.
Yes.
Like have creative
right.
moves. Do things
yes,
that
exactly.
we cannot
that's
do.
The whole point. You want it to do some novel things, but only
not
certain set of novel
yes.
things. And so so there's a whole set of really interesting and challenging research problems there. Now, I'm relatively optimistic about that because I think if we put our greatest minds on it, I believe in human ingenuity, and I think we will solve those technical problems given enough time and enough engineering. And
human intelligence, not,
yes.
not machines that will actually solve that problem.
No, well, I mean human ingenuity with some machine tools
yes.
too, right? But I'm thinking field medal prize winners, this sort of thing, will
yes.
start working on this problem. Then the second part is an ethical issue, which is... what should we use, apply these things to, right? And that's a human decision, that's a societal decision that they have to make. Like, what kinds of applications do we want to rule out? Like, for example, we've been quite vocal about ruling out the use of these AI systems for anything military, right?
You weren't, was in the news yesterday,
yes.
actually, I
we
think.
Signed, yes, and we're in the news quite often about, we
yes.
signed various UN letters against lethal autonomous weapons
yes.
and, you know, surveillance
systems.
So here
it would be robots, machines that make decisions in the battlefield.
Right, exactly.
Or
so we will never, exactly. So we've committed to never doing that, and we're never working on those systems, and we would like all other AI researchers to do that. So, and then, and you know, how do we want to deploy that in terms of jobs and safety critical systems? You know, what kind of controls we want that? These are all kind of ethical questions. And then finally, there's the strategic questions, which are more geopolitical issues, which is, you know, if these AI systems create a huge amount more productivity, does that mean a change in jobs? And I believe that wealth should be redistributed to everybody. But that means, you know, that's a political question, really. And societal question. And I think we should start discussing that now. And what are the right mechanisms to do that? You know, is it universal basic income? Is it better taxation? You know, these kinds of solutions. And I think, again, we'll get to there. But then the other issue is, like, including even things like regulation. Once we know what the right protocols are, maybe, you know, we can kind of regulate around what are the safe ways to build these systems. But those regulations need to be international. Otherwise, there's no point. Right, if China doesn't do that, or the US doesn't do that, it doesn't matter what Europe does, really. So this is interesting because, you know, I look at something like climate discussions, and it seems difficult for us as a society, as the world, to get our act together on that, even though it's obviously so pressing and quite clear what's going on. So I actually, in order of difficulty, I would order them, you know, some people would worry about the technical, but I actually worry about the strategic issues more, because I think in the end, getting humans to cooperate is going to be more difficult than engineering.
I think this is a perfect moment not to stop the discussion, but pause the discussion. And but let's thank Demis again for this discussion. And we hope to see you all back after dinner with some good questions to me that I'll actually pass on. But of course, also we'll have an opportunity for life interactions after dinner. So thank you. Okay.